I hereby introduce to you, Mr. Michael Veazey.
Hey, hey, welcome to Amazing FBA, the place to be for UK-based Amazon entrepreneurs. This is your host, Michael Veazey, and a welcome back to the podcast. This is the second half of the interview with the wonderful Peter Zapf of Global Sources. More about him in a second. Just a quick mention of the Facebook group. That's the other side of the coin, as it were. The podcast gives you lots of inspiration and information, but the Facebook group is where you go to ask questions and to have a sense of community. I think it's at the Goldilocks size right now, so it's not so small. There's nothing happening, just a few crickets playing sadly to themselves and tumbleweed going past. No, pretty lively place. On the other hand, there aren't 12,000 members, which I know one of the Amazon podcasts has a number of 12,000 people in their Facebook group, which I'm sure is a great ego boost. And, you know, there's lots of great information, but my goodness, you have to trawl through to get stuff. I mean, there's lots of good stuff that don't get me wrong, but I haven't got the time to trawl through Facebook groups with hundreds of updates a day. I mean, it's great for education, but you'll find you just spend your life on Facebook. So my advice is get into a small but thriving community. And I would like to think the Amazing FBA Facebook group is that place. So do join us there. Don't forget also that if you haven't yet joined the email list, if you want to be a member of the Amazon Insiders Club, there is now actually a membership place on the website for that. And you get access to the how-to videos, which are screencasts of me doing very simple but essential things like setting up an Amazon seller account, and also some more complex things like how to set up email capture, which I will continue to add to over the next few weeks. I'm sorry if you've been a member of that email list for a while that I've been slack on doing that. I've been busy running the business and also expanding the podcast. To sign up for that, just go to www.amazingfba.com/welcome and join us there. The podcast itself, we're going to get some lots of interviews. We've got a couple coming up, one with some currency conversion experts and other people who are then experts on other aspects of sourcing, and particularly going to talk about freight as well. But today is back to Peter Zapf of Global Sources. If you haven't yet caught it, episode 34 is where I asked Peter to answer tactical questions from the Facebook group members, and we got through every one of the ones I think that were asked. So fantastic value in that. Simple, straightforward, actionable stuff. Today is quite deliberately bigger picture, longer term thinking. So it may be a bit advanced if you're just starting out, possibly worth thinking about. But certainly if you are more advanced, if you've been around Amazon for a few months, if you've had a product live for a while, if you've got 2-3 products live and you want to scale up to a more ambitious level and a longer term viable business, this is the place to be to get some really, I think, unique content that I have not heard anywhere else. And this is from the horse's mouth, the man who really knows about this stuff. So here is Mr. Peter Zapf. Okay, so let's get on to some more strategic issues, because very interesting that was one of the first things you said to me in an email, is that I said that my listeners are probably going to want some tactical stuff, because everyone wants that when they're getting started out, and that's because it's the biggest problem. But you came up with some amazing, I thought, big picture thoughts. So would you like to talk us through that? First of all, product strategies that you came up with, the idea of commoditized versus differentiated products.
Yeah, you know, I guess one of the challenges is if everybody's following the same criteria for selecting products, everybody's going to find the same products, and then everybody's going to be competing against each other, and then it's going to be a race to the bottom and nobody makes money. Mm. So a lot of the entry level advice, which has a lot of merit, is to start with something that's easy and light, that you can airship and still make money on. And that's great. And I think that's good, definitely for starting and definitely for learning. But it is getting increasingly crowded, and there are opportunities to go outside that and have differentiated products. So for instance, we talked about ocean shipping, and I've recently seen a couple of posts where people say, oh yeah, I do larger, heavier products that I have to ocean ship, and I have virtually no competition.
Wow, interesting. Virtually no competition is like words that I haven't heard on Amazon for a long time now.
Exactly. So, I mean, that'll get competitive too, but the barrier to entry for products that are ocean shipped is a little bit higher, because you probably need a little bit more capital up front. Their capital is going to be, you know, sitting on the ocean for a while, so it's not going to turn into cash as quickly. There are also the logistics costs. You probably have to do a larger order for it to make sense. But those additional barriers to entry may be sufficient to put you in a less competitive area. That being said, you know, like I said at the beginning, I don't think there's anything wrong with starting with, you know, whether it's retail arbitrage or commoditized products. If you're doing that so that you can learn about Amazon, so that you can learn about PPC, so that you can learn about how to rank on Amazon and how to get reviews on Amazon, how to manage the reviews, and maybe how to manage the hijackers and, you know, all the other kind of Amazon-specific issues. Mm. But once you've learned all those Amazon-specific issues, if you can move into product areas that are less competitive with good margin, that seems like a good business proposition.
Fantastic. And I love the clarity of thought about this, that you're going in with certain types of products in order to learn the system and learn your skills, but then that's actually not likely to be a long-term sustainable product, which is really good, clear thinking. And I think that's actually very different from how quite a few Amazon courses have been pitching things, which is like kind of go and slap a private label on a product and hey presto, that's your business done, which is not how I've experienced it or many other Amazon sellers that are my friends, like probably hundreds of them now. So very, very interesting that you differentiate between this is a good way to get started and this is a sustainable business model. So
yeah, the step after that, maybe this is where you're going. The step after that, you know, is to think about, do I want a supplier design product or do I want my own design product? So with the supplier design product, you know, a lot of other people can approach the same supplier, get the same product. And then instead of competing for the buy box, which is what you do in retail arbitrage, you're now competing for ranking, right? And, you know, I guess the standard examples are the yoga mats or the garlic presses, where suddenly you have a lot of people selling the same products. But if you move toward having your own design, that can be a barrier of entry. Now, the thicker yoga mat or the longer yoga mat isn't a barrier for very long because it's pretty easy for people to copy that. So your next question is, you know, how difficult is your design to copy? And difficulty is typically going to be related to, or often going to be related to, amount of money to invest. So like if you need to spend a bunch of money for a new mold for a product, right, because you have a different casing for it, well, now that's going to be a little bit more differentiated. Fewer people are going to do that. And you may have a longer life cycle for being able to sell that product and generate profit and margin, but you do have a higher upfront cost and you're taking more risk.
Okay, so there's a payoff basically between the money you invest up front and the level of risk you have and the longevity of the product in all likelihood.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, sorry to get very abstract and complicated, but then you start saying, okay, how do I minimize that upfront risk? Right? How do I have because your upfront costs for some products could include regulatory compliance costs, costs for a designer, costs for a mold, maybe costs for contracts with the manufacturer and supplier. You know, how do I manage those costs in a way to keep them as low as possible so that, let's say I do 8 products, I only need 4 of them to be successful to be profitable rather than needing 5 of them to be successful to be profitable.
Okay. And so that's probably beyond the scope of this podcast, but there are ways to minimize those risks then.
Well, and there you're managing your costs. So I there was a company in the US, I think it was Quirky, I think was their name. I think they went out of business. But in one of the articles about them, I read that they spent $800,000 designing a Bluetooth speaker.
Right.
I don't even know how you can get to $800,000 designing a Bluetooth speaker. And then they sold 30 units of it.
Ow. That's seriously painful numbers. Wow.
Right.
Yeah.
You want to bring that upfront number as low as possible. And obviously you want that sales number to be as high as possible.
Yeah. So I suppose what we're sort of inching towards somehow, and what I'm seeing more and more, is that it's a process of different levels of steps. I mean, you just outlined, if I sort of feed back to you, make sure I understand this, because this is a deeper level of thought than mostly goes around the Amazon sort of sales community, as you might imagine, or as you can see from your experience of that, I think, because you've been on this podcast before, so there's loads of them out there. So basically, it's about going from something really commoditized up to your own design, and then thinking about making the design hard to copy, and then really thinking about bigger and bigger investments, but it's all about sort of
getting some kind of reality check at each level of the process. Is that a fair way of putting it?
Yeah, no, I think those are all fair points. And I'm sorry, another cost that I didn't include was trademarking and patent protection, right, as you get even more complicated, right? So now we're at, you know, university level strategies.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's possibly where we might sort of top out. But just to say to anyone listening, like occasionally, actually not that occasionally, quite often I get questions like, should I trademark my product or should I patent my product? And my understanding is that the ballpark figure you're looking at to get a good patent attorney in the US is something like $50,000. So I don't know if that ties in with anything you know.
That's higher than I would have expected.
Okay.
But I'm not, it's not something that I've spent a lot of time researching. That's a good question. I'm going to ask some people about that. Trademark can be a lot less expensive. I think if you do it through LegalZoom or something, less than $500. I don't remember.
Oh, certainly that's less very interesting. That's a very, so trademark is broadly speaking a lot less expensive than a patent. I mean, of course, you're not a lawyer.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's worth knowing. LegalZoom, that sounds good. Well, that sounds like something that one should consider perhaps early in the process, but yeah, quite complex questions, aren't they? But yeah, that is something that's worth looking into. I mean, I'll look into that as well and post some notes up if I find something that looks obviously well, you know, well put together and easy to follow.
I was just going to move on from the product strategies to logistics, which we talked about earlier, but I'll say it again. Yeah. So, you know, You can make a lot of money with commoditized products, but you're not going to make a lot of money airshipping those commoditized products when your competitors, you know, are doing something else. So I saw a slide once. I think it was from a company called Hacks. They're a hardware accelerator in China, and they pointed out that you really need to start thinking about your supply chain costs. And we talked about that earlier, and that would be, you know, as your product gets more mature and there's more competitors, you know, whether direct or indirect, you need to start thinking about your ocean shipping or your supply chain costs. And a big component of that is going to be your shipping. So, you know, to minimize your shipping costs, how do you fill a container? And then how do you, and with Amazon, this is hard, but when it gets to California, how do you spend $200 shipping it to Amazon's California fulfillment center rather than $2,000 splitting it to a warehouse in New Jersey and one in Florida and one in Chicago? You know, those are some of the logistics costs, you know, plus working with the factory to start ordering at quantities that give them, that allow you to get the best costs. You might start looking at your packaging costs for a lot of, depending on what you're doing with packaging, that can start being material. So when you start looking at all these costs, you can start thinking about how do I improve those costs so that I can become either more price competitive or have more margin that I can apply to PPC spend.
Okay, makes a lot of sense. So filling a container, getting it sort of the shortest distance possible once it's got to the seaport, basically, in the US. As you say, with Amazon, that is quite tricky in that they will tell you where it's got to go. But on the other hand, if you are going, for example, to FBA inspection, which is in California, or Earth Class Mail in Oregon, then the onward shipping is determined by Amazon, and it's pretty cheap because they have got an incredible deal with UPS. So that's possibly and something actually, that is less relevant. I'm not sure.
Yeah, and there's actually two ways to do this. And I was talking to the guys at Flexport. You can either have your freight forwarder take it all the way to Amazon. But if you do that, you need to set it up all in Seller Central before the shipment leaves China.
Okay.
As an alternative to going to a third party like FBA inspection, usually the freight forwarder will have their own warehouse. So just ship to your freight forwarder's warehouse. And then when it gets there, they'll tell you. Then you generate the pallet labels and, you know, the rest of the information from Seller Central for the local pickup from the Amazon appointed carrier, and your freight forwarder's warehousing folks can take care of everything to get the shipment ready to be picked up.
Yeah, okay, that makes a lot of sense. So in other words, you're not bothering with sort of third parties. You're using Freight Forwarder, and then you go straight to Seller Central and set up the shipping straight out of their warehouse. So you're not involving FBA Inspection or Earth Class Mail or whoever else is doing it these days.
Yep.
Interesting, interesting. So you're basically, the whole mentality is you're going back over the supply chain and at each point trying to either cut out a link in the chain that's not needed or reduce the costs or make more for the same cost, that kind of thing.
That's exactly right, yep.
Amazing. Good, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, certainly I'm in a position where I've been air freighting, for example, about 1,000 units of a product, which is, it's oh, what is it, 150 grams or 5 ounces, so it's beginning to get to the point where if I stick in another 1,000 or 1,500 unit order, I really should be grasping the nettle and looking at sea freight. Interesting.
Yeah. You know, or do a 3,000 unit order. Hey, another thing on the ocean, if, you know, in some cases Amazon asks you to break down the pallets, you know, to ship to three different distribution centers.
Yeah.
If you set everything up in Seller Central before the products leave China, you can get the China supplier to pack the pallets properly. You know, so these two pallets are for one facility, these three are for another, these two are for another. The advantage of that is now your freight forwarder isn't going to charge you for breaking down and building up the pallets again.
Okay, so can you just explain to the ignorance amongst us, which is includes me, exactly what a pallet is? I mean, I got a rough idea.
right.
Sorry, excuse my ignorance.
All right. No problem. So a pallet, it's the wooden thing that a forklift sticks its prongs into so it can pick up a bunch of products at the same time.
Okay, good. I thought that was what it was, but I thought I'd better just check that I wasn't
no problem.
On the wrong direction.
And if you're shipping by ocean, usually you're going to put your cartons will be packed on top of a pallet to make them easier to move.
So in other words, so you get the supplier to break it down. So in other words, as early in the supply chain as possible, you set in Amazon Seller Central or however you do it, where it's going to, and then as early as you can, you get it separated out, ready to do those things so that there's less reworking or less sort of extra work later in the process. Is that about right?
Yes. And I'd say overall, it's because if I oversimplify it, the supplier will do it for free and your freight forwarder will charge you to do it.
Great. Okay. That's well put. And I have to say there's a couple of things like that. For example, I got the supplier to print and put in a bunch of inserts, which when I tried to get it done in the USA one time, I forgot to do it, cost me something like 10 times as much. It wasn't quite free, but it was as close to free as you're going to get. So,
right. Or get the supplier to put on your FN SKU labels instead of Amazon or another intermediary, and the suppliers will do it free or near free.
Yeah, exactly. That's my experience with the product packaging. I've built in the FNSKU label because it was only going to be on Amazon into the barcode, you know, into the packaging. And they did that for free. Exactly. So that's the kind of thing. That's really, really good. Now, you've got a couple of other points that you were going to make about competing against China factories themselves.
Yeah. So a lot of people very legitimately wonder, hey, if I sell on Amazon and I source from this factory, won't the factory figure out that I'm selling on Amazon and then just, you know, bypass me and sell directly on Amazon? And to be fair, I would say that probably every factory owner is thinking about that and talking about that and really excited about the opportunity of trying to sell direct to consumers. But, and there are a lot of big buts, these factories, they're used to getting paid up front. So the first thing that changes when you sell on Amazon is you're no longer getting paid up front, you know, before you manufacture. You're getting paid after you manufacture, after you've shipped the product, and after the consumer has purchased. So that's one huge but for the factories. Second thing is, you know, the factories, they're not so good at managing listings, managing customer service, managing a lot of these other issues. So in general, we're not seeing a lot of factories have success at selling on Amazon. That's not to say there aren't any, you know, some will be successful, but it's a whole different team, right? You have your manufacturing team. They're good at sourcing products, they're good at assembly, maybe they're good at, hopefully they're good at QC. They don't know anything about you know, Amazon PPC marketing, good listings, good photography, good copy, good back end keywords. You know, they don't know that stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting because I had a tiny personal experience of that. I went to a factory and I sourced unbranded samples, i.e. I just wanted to get 200 units to see if it would sell and check the product quality and stuff. And I had it listed and I got it ranked on page one of Amazon for a while. It then kind of dropped off because the quality wasn't very good, actually. But I discovered by just sort of idly looking through pretty much all the pages that came up under my main keyword one day that my factory actually had their own listing of the exact same product, but it was on like page 18 or something. So that was an example of the fact that they're just not geared to it, really. They're just not
So they'll often try, but they may not be successful. Now, where the competition does come in from, though, is the domestic China private label guys.
Right.
So there are a ton of China private label sellers in Shenzhen.
Right.
And some of them are very successful. And I've had the opportunity to talk to a couple of them. But what they'll say is, look, our disadvantage, we don't understand the consumer and we don't understand the consumer needs.
Right.
So for non-commoditized products, they're not as good at those. For very commoditized products like power banks, they're very good at those. So, you know, I'd watch out for the China private label guys, and you know, some are on one extreme, they're doing the hijacking. But others are also developing their own brands with high quality products and competing very aggressively on price and being very successful. So that's where, you know, potential competition comes in. That said, the market's huge. There's still a ton of opportunity for everybody.
Yeah, very interesting. But what you're saying, I mean, pretty much everything's pointing back to the same thing, which is the commoditized stuff is going to be shopped on price. And basically, that's going to be more and more of a danger area.
You know, I'd say as an American, as a Brit for a lot of your listeners, you know, you understand your local market better. So it's easier for you to identify product needs or market needs and then communicate with the factory requesting product changes or product improvements that would meet those needs. And it's much easier for you to figure those out than it is for the factory guy to figure that out, who's, you know, in China with local people that have much different needs.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
To the extent you can take advantage of that, that will really help you be successful.
Great. That makes a lot of sense. So in other words, the main power that we have that we need to leverage is really our understanding of our customers rather than anything else.
I think on the product selection side, certainly. I mean, certainly also the native English language skills, the knowledge of, you know, what passes for good product photography and what passes for a good product listing. I mean, that's helpful also. And that's really on the marketing side.
Yeah. So in other words, it's marketing and customer understanding more than anything else that we can compete on. So Definitely. Then the last thing, if you have time, and this is gold dust, by the way, thank you so much. Not gold dust, gold nuggets. But differentiating your products, which is, again, a theme that's coming up again and again in this whole discussion. What are your thoughts on that in terms of the sort of bigger picture going forward, where you can go with this stuff if you want to?
Yeah, so actually, we talked about differentiated products and that they may require a higher upfront investment, and then thinking about how do you mitigate the risk of that upfront investment. So super interesting, over the past couple of years, crowdfunding has become very popular. So one way to mitigate that risk is to get your design, then post your design. I mean, I'm oversimplifying it, right? Get your design, post your design on Kickstarter or Indiegogo, raise a bunch of money, but basically you're not raising the money. You're validating the idea, getting the money up front that will then get you through that initial production run. And now you've really mitigated your kind of new idea risk. Once you've gotten through that phase, then you move to your online Amazon sales. And once you've gotten through that phase, you then leverage your good margins, good sales volume, good product ratings, and you can go to retailers and say, hey, I'm selling this product on Amazon. It's got good margins. I mean, the math works for me to sell it to you and you to make money also.
Right.
It's got good product reviews. And it's got good sales volume. Mr. Retailer, you should pick this up. So I can see that some products and brands will be successful starting with crowdfunding to minimize risk, then using online or Amazon to prove broad market acceptance, and then leveraging that Amazon success to get into brick and mortar retail.
Interesting. So this is like a really big picture possibility for those who are really ambitious to basically develop their own products and then leverage the Amazon experience. Well, to use Amazon as a springboard, so between the Kickstarter thing and then between the big box retailers, as you put it.
Yeah, and in some cases, we've seen the big box retailers, they'll directly contact the Kickstarter guys, especially for the super successful projects. But not everybody's going to have a super successful project. So if you have a medium successful product, but you can turn that into a good success on Amazon and a story that then you can extend into retail. And that'll typically be, I talked about margins, product ratings, and sales volume. There are other things the retailers are looking for. For instance, they want to know, hey, can you replenish when I sell out? So then you may need to have some local warehousing and be able to ship, with 2 weeks notice instead of with 3 months notice that ocean shipping typically requires. But yes, right. Still at a high level, crowdfunding, online, retail.
Wow, interesting. Yeah, well, it's interesting to put the bigger picture out there. And I think most of the listeners are not at that stage yet, but there are certainly those who are ambitious and have a strong business background that may well want to look to the future and how to deal with these, the bigger opportunities. And also to not just think about Amazon, because at the end of the day, Amazon is so many things at once. I think people get confused because it is a marketing channel, because all the buyers are there. It's a sales channel and it's a delivery channel because of their warehousing. But actually, it doesn't have to be all of those things, and it can just be a starting point for something bigger.
Yeah, and I heard some of the other folks, talk about, do you have an Amazon business, or are you running your own brand? And if you consider yourself as an Amazon business, you're playing in Amazon's ballpark, and they make the rules, and they could change the rules against you.
For sure, and they frequently seem to as well.
So, it's a great channel. It gives great... it's the easiest access to high volume sales that has ever existed in history, which is great, but yeah. It comes with some risks as well.
Yeah, that's beautifully succinctly put. That is absolutely my experience to a T, and it will continue to be, I think. Peter, amazing, amazing information. I love the detail and the big picture thinking. That's such a great combination. Have you got any other sort of parting words or thoughts for people who are either out just getting started, or maybe they've two or three products launched and they want to take it to the next level?
I guess the main thing would be don't let setbacks hold you back. Learn from them and then move on. It's probably pretty easy to make an incorrect product selection and be not successful and then get frustrated. But even with an incorrect product selection an unsuccessful product selection, you're still learning so much else. You're learning the logistics process. You're learning how to work with suppliers. You're learning how to get products into the country. You're learning how to get stuff listed on Amazon. That now you can take all of those skills to the next product and be successful. So I think there are a ton of huge opportunities. And of course, then I have to go back to the beginning and say, and when you are looking for products, look for them on globalsources.com or visit our trade shows.
Of course, yeah. I was going to say, do you have any sort of... Of course. Global Sources is something I have to say, before I heard about you and that company, that it wasn't something that had appeared on my radar, which now I know how big it is, surprises me. And is there... are there particular resources that you recommend people to look at, particular websites, sort of downloadable guides that you have, anything like that?
In terms of the process, the sourcing process, I'd suggest looking at smartchinasourcing.com. Globalsources.com and our trade shows are really more for meeting suppliers directly. So that's very product-centric, but more process-centric information. We have a fair amount on smartchinasourcing.com. A fair amount of the content on Smart China Sourcing we do republish from other parties. So you can always look at the author. If you find an article that with a topic that you're very interested in, see who the author is and the website they come from, and go look at their website also. A ton of the service providers provide content for us on Smart China Sourcing in addition to our own content.
Fantastic. Well, that sounds like an amazing resource. I'm going to have to check that out myself when I get off this interview. Well, Peter, only remains for me to say thank you so much for your time. I know you're a busy guy between all the demands of your job and wanting to get back to see your family, and so many really, really useful things. For me, just knowing that I need to put my quality criteria up front in the purchase order, I really wish I'd known that. That's going to be a lifesaver in itself. So thank you so much. Really fantastic.
Oh, Michael, no, thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate your time and the invitation to join, and I hope that your audience finds it useful. So thanks again for having me on.
Thank you so much.
Wow, what an interesting and thought-provoking set of thoughts that was. I really respect Peter Zapf. I mean, he's very clearly a man who has his finger on the pulse and also, at the same time, has a long-term perspective. So he really knows where things have come from. And that's one of the best ways to know where things are going, if you take a sort of long-term and a short-term view and combine them. So pretty fascinating stuff. I mean, this is not for beginners. This is not easy stuff that he's talking about. But I really think if you've already been launched a few months, and as I said, if you've got two or three products live, or you're turning over, I don't know, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 a month at that sort of level up, you probably want to be thinking about the longer term picture if you're getting serious about it. And I think even if you aren't thinking in terms of doing something that yourself, the very least you need to do is be aware of the changing environment around you and what your competition's up to you, and you know how you might want to start dealing with that. So I think this has been one of the most valuable episodes I've ever come across in a podcast, not because I'm so great, I'm not, just still learning like all of us, but I really think that Peter's onto something very, very powerful. So I'd really urge you to go back over that. I've made very, very detailed blog notes, about three times as long as they normally would be, because I think I wanted to capture all of the detail of what he was saying. So do go read those, as ever the blog notes are at the corresponding number for the podcast episode. So in this case, that's www.amazingfba.com/35. So do go and make use of that. And of course, if you haven't yet listened to it, go back to episode 34 and check that out as well. The show notes for that will be at www.amazingfba.com/34. It only really remains for me to say that although this stuff is harder to go and implement straight away, it really will pay you dividends if you just go and action as much as you can, even just starting the mindset of looking at two things. Number one, how can you differentiate your product? It's all about differentiation. If you get a commoditized product, as Peter's made very clear, you're basically on a hiding to nothing. It's not a bad place to start. And if that's where you're at the moment, don't panic. Don't give yourself a hard time. But start that process now of looking at how to make your product different. There's lots of different ways, and we can come up with a tactical program on that. And I certainly will be happy to do that if you give me feedback in the Facebook group that that's what you want. But also think about the supply chain and how can you make it slicker? How can you make it more cost effective, efficiencies of scale? Once you've, you know, sold a few hundred units and you've air freighted them, what about sea shipping? And again, sea shipping is probably a specialist topic that we should get an expert on. I do know a British-based freight forwarder, and obviously the importance of a freight forwarder has become even more clear after Peter's explanation. So I think it's a good time to get that on as well. Let me know, as ever, at the Facebook group what your thoughts are about that. And if there is an enthusiasm for that, I will approach him and we'll get him on the podcast as well. So whatever way you can, even with the strategic stuff, remember, learn, do, i.e. look through your business and think. Sometimes thinking is work, and sometimes that's the hardest work. And then review, you know, try stuff out. If you're not sure, try stuff, you know, go and talk to somebody who's done it before. So don't just reinvent the wheel. Find yourself a mentor, get yourself a mastermind group, hang out with the right kinds of guys and girls, and then go and do this stuff. You're going to sometimes have to bite the bullet and borrow money or, you know, scale up beyond a level that you're totally comfortable with to really test out something like sea shipping. Now, I'm not saying do that at the beginning. I'm not saying go and borrow a bunch of money for an unproven product. That I don't think is prudent. But when you get to that level, which is something I'm approaching now, needing to go and raise more capital and look at sea shipping, then, you know, that's the level you've got to do to grow. Then, my friends, you've got to pluck up the courage. And as I said in my previous episode, courage and honesty and wisdom. So in other words, don't throw money around when you don't know what you're doing yet. That's just wisdom. But have the courage when you know what it is that you should be doing to get on with that. Don't let that block you. And I've got to say that to myself, because actually I know what I need to do next to scale up, and I'm a bit scared, but I'm going to have to go and get on with it, because I know that if I don't step up, the business is going to stagnate and I am going to kick myself in 6 months' time or even 3 months' time. And then, of course, the other element that I mentioned in the previous podcast is honesty. So just make sure you look at the numbers and just don't kid yourself. If it all went wrong, at least you've learned from it. So with that in mind, guys, I will leave you to get on with your days. And evenings. I hope you're having fun. If you're running, if you're listening in the car, if you're on the way back from work to your family, whatever it is you're doing, I wish you all the very best. And I'm very, very grateful for your listening attention and all the love and attention you give each other in the Facebook group. It's a fantastic thing to be part of. So, guys, I will speak to you in episode 36.